Now we're going to move on to study session. We'll begin with a review of the October 1st agenda. Council, if you wouldn't mind looking at the agenda. Item 3 are liquor licenses. Item 4 are contracts, and I think Mr. Freeman had a question or two. Mr. Freeman.
I do. Thank you, Vice Mayor. Let's see. So I had a question on 4E, talking about the storm cleanup, Mr. Brady, and everything that went on there. I think that I know we're authorizing spending some additional monies to pay for the contract to remove all the trees. Is that correct?
Correct.
With that, I think in the future, you know, the cemetery was severely damaged, and maybe this is time when we can evaluate the cemetery use, spacing of the trees, get a landscape architect in there and kind of create some more space there within the cemetery. Being I have a lot of family members and been contacted by family members that have that are laid there to rest. Maybe it's time just to analyze and look what we can do to better support the cemetery. And I think there was one other thing there, but regardless, if that could be part of the plan. And I know there's some irrigation issues. There's portions of the cemetery that could be, with a landscape architect, could be opened up, maybe a place of people can grieve or go there for solace in the cemetery. And just maybe look at the overall concept there.
Sure. Mayor, Vice Mayor, Council, Member Freeman, we'll be glad to do that. I think it would be good, as we get closer to the budget discussions, we can share with Council that this is a specific designated fund at the cemetery. It's not the general fund. So
yeah,
we try to make it work within the fees that we're doing, as well as the long-term maintenance out there. So I'm sure we can put together a plan. There are constraints based upon the way that's funded as a kind of a self-perpetuating fund, but we'll be glad to look at some of the options out there. I think this item, frankly, is just picking up we've already done the work.
Yeah.
It's actually recognizing that we had to do some emergency expenses because of the storm, and we're just ratifying those additional expenses. But we'll be glad to come back and have a discussion about some opportunities to do some additional landscaping or change of landscaping, as well as irrigation in the cemetery.
Thank you, sir.
Great. Any other questions on item 4? I think you had another question.
Oh, I did.
Yeah, Mr. Freeman.
4H, about the armor vests that the fire department's getting. I thought perhaps maybe the fire department want to come up and maybe share some information. I thought that was very unique, why the fire department's getting armored vests for the personnel and why they're doing it, especially for our residents of our community. And obviously, there's been some mass casualty incidents in the United States, and probably preparing for that. So, welcome, Chiefs.
Thank you, Chiefs.
Thanks.
Good morning, Council.
So, Mayor, Vice Mayor, Council, thank you for asking a couple of questions about what we're moving forward with. As all of you know, there's been some significant changes in the risks and what's the climate in our world today. So, the fire department has worked really, really hard closely with the police department to try to keep up with the changing risks. So that's why you're seeing ballistic vests and helmets on a purchase for the fire department. Some of you are aware of a new model that's been out for probably the last 4 or 5 years. We have transitioned to that as a region. The automatic aid region, which is made up of the entire fire consortium across Maricopa County, has spent several years working together, probably started under Chief Dunn when he still had training, working together as a region to come up with an agreed upon policy and procedures on how we would respond to any type of a active shooter hostile event, working closely with our PD partners. The policy went into place, or the policy was written and completed about 4 months ago. Most of the surrounding agencies are in the process, right where we are, of delivering some new training. These followed national standards that have been recommended by NFPA 3000, several white papers that have been put out by by the FBI and Homeland Defense. So what we've done is partnered with our PD partners to change the way that we respond to large events. And what we want to make sure that we're doing is providing our members with the appropriate protective equipment. As most of you know, we follow a pretty hard and fast policy on what we will risk. And we will risk a lot for a savable life. And that's where this thought process came from, is in the event of a large-scale active shooter or mass casualty, we want to make sure that we are saving savable lives while protecting our personnel to the highest level. So that was what was the pretense of us moving in this direction. And the Rescue Task Force is a nationally recognized model that will allow us to respond to those events in what we feel like is a very calculated manner.
Chief Rankin, anything you want to add? Or?
Yes, sir. So as you know, law enforcement as well as the fire service is ever evolving based on the threats that we see in our society. You know, back when I began this career 23 years ago, we changed our model after Columbine. And that model of the service that we provide in emergency services continues to evolve. And again, when you look at the number of incidences of mass casualties that have occurred since 2000, between 2000 and 2017, over 250 events within our country. Out of those 250 events, we looked at over 800 deaths and 2,200 casualties. So this is really an evolution intended to really shift the focus and the risk away from the victim and really onto the responder, meaning that we could eliminate some of the time that it takes for us to enter a warm zone, extract, stabilize the victim, and bring them into the cold zone where they could receive the proper treatment. So we've been working closely with the fire department, and we believe that beginning in January through June that we'll be able to train all our officers as well as firefighters in a rescue task force. So we'll one iteration, 20 officers, 20 firefighters every week from January through June, and I think we'll be on task.
Thank you so much for telling us about that, because I think the public needs to know what we're doing and how we're doing it, and working cooperatively together has worked really well. So I appreciate your insights and look forward to successes, and hopefully we don't have to use the equipment.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's our hope too. We will certainly share some information as we start. This phase will start in January. Is actually our third phase. We've already gone through phase one and phase two, which has been very, very well received, and it's gone over really well between fire and PD both. Phase three is going to be more of a hands-on event, and I think that would be something that would be really interesting for you guys to come out and see. So if there's some interest, we'll send that out to all of you and let you know what dates we have. It's going to go on for about 5 months, I think. So there'll be several days available, and we'll certainly make sure that you're aware if you'd like to come out and watch one of the exercises.
So is that preparing for an active shooter event? Is that what you're doing?
It is, yeah. It's going to be, so as you, if you want, I've got a couple of pictures of what a rescue task force kind of looks like in terms of a response, and then what the equipment is that we will be purchasing. But what this hands-on, full-scale of exercise will be is our police officers and our firefighters coming together to actually form a rescue task force and then go in and make extrication extricate patients out of a warm zone, identifying what's a warm zone, what's a cold zone, where our casualty collection points will be, and for us to work together to understand how to follow commands from the PD side, for the police officers to understand what the treatment is going to look like and the triage is going to look like in that warm zone. We're pretty excited about it. We've been able to go out and participate with some of the other agencies that are in the middle of it as well, and it's been very well received by the firefighters as well as the police officers.
Do you have a picture?
Jill, do I have a picture?
Oh, okay.
So what you're looking at there is the police officers. What we've decided to do, and I'll show you in a little bit later slide, that we've decided as an organization that we want to make sure that we can clearly identify who a firefighter is versus who a police officer is. You can see in this picture that it's somewhat hard to tell other than the guns. I guess that's an easy way to tell. Yeah, the blue gloves are a giveaway, huh? So you can see that what they do is they form up in a diamond formation, and the officers basically are a security detail for the firefighters as they lead them into the warm zone, and then they stand security around them. The next slide kind of shows what that would look like if you're treating. So the firefighters are doing treatment while the officers are truly straight security for that team. Our police officer brothers and sisters have been amazing about understanding that we are really very, very dependent on them for our security, and so the expectation will be that they are going to truly guard us while our firefighters are doing treatment. Just a couple more pictures of how you would lead them in. You can see that some of these are from all over the country. The model that we've decided to go with in terms of our vests is it's called SAND, but it really matches our turnout. So what we thought was it's easy to designate the difference between our police officers, who are always wearing the black or the blue ballistic vests, and then ours would be more of our turnout color. Mm-hmm. And then we've gone with a helmet, ballistic helmet, and it's very, very similar to how our fire helmets operate, so our personnel were very, very comfortable with it, as well as giving us some pretty significant PPE in the event that something goes bad. So that's what we're doing.
Great.
Love it. Thank you.
Awesome.
What's PPE?
Oh, sorry. Personal protective equipment.
Okay. Thank you.
I apologize, Vice Mayor.
Great. Thank you very much. Council, any other questions? Any questions on item 4? Moving to resolutions, any questions on item 5? Mr. Smith.
Vice Mayor and Council, as items 5B and 5C, these are extensions to our cable license agreements. And there's a really good story about them, and so I want to just share the story about them. And that is in the last legislative session, the industry and municipalities worked together on a piece of legislation that creates a license process that is both uniform and streamlined throughout the state. And that process is going to go into effect in 2020. And so what these extensions do is fill that gap. So we're extending our existing licenses into 2020. And then once we get into 2020, we go into a statewide uniform license process. And in fact, these extensions will be the last licenses that come to council, because in the future, it's more akin to a permit, almost like a right-of-way type permit type of process that will be handled administratively. And so these are your last cable licenses that you'll see. We will bring some conforming changes to our code in the future. But other than that, in the future, it's going to be a streamlined statewide process, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Smith, are we going to be able to retain our PEG channels? Is that going to be an issue?
The short answer is yes. There is the legislation does set forth that, but our existing channels will keep. And okay. I'm looking back to the technical, too.
Mary Grace, okay. Okay. Council, any questions?
I do have.
Yeah, Mr. Freeman.
5A is about... I just want to make note irrigation water districts for areas of our community that do have water irrigation. They create their own irrigation districts, and that helps spread out the costs to the homeowners in that area, and I think that's vital. It kind of levels the playing field when irrigation repairs have to be made into a district. So just want the council to be aware that's an important thing if portions of our neighborhoods want to create this irrigation water delivery district. And then there's actually a cost to that. It's put on their tax bill. Mm-hmm. And then they have to pay for that assessment every year. So it's a good thing. Thank you.
Great. Any other questions on 5? Number 6, ordinance. And 7. Mayor, any questions?
No, thank you. I'm good.
We have annexation. Okay. Great. All righty. We'll move on to our agenda on the study session. So we're going to invite Gary Manning. Gary Manning. Yeah. Gary Manning and Jan Ashley, they're going to present on benefits.
Good morning, Mayor, Vice Mayor, and Council. I'm Gary Manning with Human Resources, and with me today is Jan Ashley, our Benefits Administrator. This is our annual benefits presentation where we get to provide you an overview of what benefit offerings we're going to be providing to our employees and retirees and dependents next year and some of the changes that we anticipate making to them. Really, the first slide we have for you is just a reminder of the major benefit offerings that the city provides to our employees and retirees and dependents. We have three medical plans. We have three dental plans, two vision care plans. We do offer an employee assistance program. We do offer both basic and group term life insurance program. And of course, we have our employee health and wellness center that provides primary care services to our employees and dependents. Last June, we did open up the Wellness Center to some retirees who met certain eligibility criteria, and we think that's been working rather well. We're pleased with the Wellness Center. The last statistics that we saw, even in the slower than usual summer months with visitation, our utilization is still about 78%, and the Wellness Center is still seeing on average about 60 new patients a month. Another interesting note, as of the 22nd of next month, the Wellness Center will have been open 4 years. So it's hard to imagine that much time really has passed, but we're excited about the services that it provides. All of these benefits are funded through the Employee Benefit Trust Fund, which receives its money primarily through both retiree and employee premium contributions, but we do receive some subsidies from the Arizona State Retirement System. We've had a good year with medical claims cost due primarily to lower medical claims costs through our active population as well as continued low administrative fees charged by Cigna. Next year, our active population will see a 3% increase in premiums, which is far lower than the 8% that we forecasted last year. So what that means is, depending on who the employees and which plan they've selected and whether it's a single coverage or family coverage, those increases are going to range anywhere between $4 and $17 a month.
Mr. Thompson has a question.
Gary, I thought when we switched over from Blue Shield, Blue Cross to Cigna that we had a locked-in rate for a certain amount of years. Is that not the case?
That is still the case. We have a five-year rate guarantee. Now, those are just the administrative fees that Cigna provides.
Okay, so that
is still the same. There has been no change in those lower administrative fees that we've been receiving as opposed to what we had through Ameriband. No change in those.
So, Gary, but let's... I think it'd be helpful to give counsel, because even the employees kind of get confused by this. So we pay an administrative fee to Cigna to manage the program, but that certainly is important, but one of the bigger drivers of these numbers is the actual claims cost.
Yes.
Now, obviously, they play a role in that, but there's a fee that we pay them. So talk a little bit about, you or Jan, talk a little bit about the history, more recent history as far as claims, especially like where we kind of what we call the severe yep. claims, and why we're able to do this decrease. This decrease didn't just come because of Cigna necessarily, maybe
Correct.
Helped out, but talk about our claims experience.
Yep.
Because I think that's important.
Mayor, Vice Mayor, and Council, the primary driver behind premium rate increases is really a rate analysis of what the claims costs are. Quite a number of years ago, we decoupled the active population from the retiree population, and we look at those claims costs separately, and we look at a trend line to see what have claims costs been in the past, what do we forecast them to be in the future. 2 or 3, maybe 4 years ago, we had some significantly bad years in terms of claims costs because we had quite a number of very high-dollar claims. Somewhere between 20 to 30 very high dollar claims that were at least $100,000, if more, and a handful of them were $300,000 or more. We thought maybe that would just be a 1 year anomaly. It turned out not to be that way. We had a couple of really bad years that way. But For whatever reason, those really severe high-dollar claims have been reduced over the last couple of years, and those tend to be really the primary drivers behind where those costs are. So I'm happy to say within the last couple of years, we've just not had the number of those really severe high-dollar claims that we have in the past. And as a result, we feel like retirees, we're bringing in sufficient revenue to cover their costs, so we're not recommending any premium increases on the retiree population. But we anticipate that we might be somewhere around 3% short on the active side. Other financial considerations, again, we are hopeful that we're going to see a continued reduction of those high-dollar claims in the future. And Jan has done a terrific job of putting into place a new program working with the federal government where we actually receive much higher prescription drug subsidies on our Medicare Part D program for our retirees that are 65 and older. We actually receive somewhere around $1 million a year in prescription drug subsidies, so she has done a terrific job on that. There are some overall health plan design changes that we're anticipating that we think are going to benefit the employees. First, we will be reducing out-of-pocket maximums on both the basic and the choice plans by between $600 and $650 per person. What that means is the employee will spend $600 to $650 less in their out-of-pocket maximums before they reach the maximum upon which the plan then pays 100%. Second, on the vision plan, we're going to be increasing our frame allowance from $130 to $150. And those ever popular but expensive progressive lenses, we're going to be able to cover those next year with merely a $10 copay. On the dental plan, we're increasing the dental plan maximum benefit by $300 per year per person. Just a note that our dental plan is already pretty rich, quite competitive in the market with other sister cities, so this is going to make it ever more so. This slide is really just gives you an overall view of what the city and the employee contributions will be next year. The very last column in yellow shows you what the difference in premiums will be for employees between this year and next. So, for example, in the middle of the page, employees that are on the single choice plan will see about a $4 a month increase. If they're on the family plan, it'll be $8. Employees that are on the copay single plan will see a $6 increase, and family increases will be about $17 a month. Other benefits, through a highly competitive RFP process, we have selected some new insurance carriers. So, for example, MetLife is going to be covering for us next year group term life insurance. A company called Unum is going to be covering our short-term disability insurance. And Cigna is going to cover our travel, business travel accident and commuter travel accident insurance. Just a note, MetLife is the largest group term life insurance carrier in the country, and Unum is also the number one largest short-term disability insurance carrier in the country as well. We're excited about them being with us. They come with lots of experience and lots of buying power. Open enrollment this year for us will be October 10th through October 24th. It will be considered a passive enrollment, which just means if you don't want to do anything different, you don't have to. With the exception of flexible spending, you will have to either enroll or re-enroll in flexible spending. The employee and the health and wellness benefits fair is going to be October 11th from 9 to 2. That's over in the Mesa Convention Center, as we have had in prior years. The ever popular flu shots will be there, so if you haven't got those, feel free. And there will be a number of other health and wellness welfare offerings there as well. And that is it.
So I think we kind of glossed over the big deal here.
Yeah.
So, which is so it's fine. But I've been making a big deal of it, and I think people see it. And we probably should highlight it. So we talk about the 3% increase, and we highlighted the difference mm-hmm. or the increases per month, which over a year's period of time, the largest group of employees, correct me if I'm wrong, Jan, are probably in the choice 80% plan for family.
Correct. Yes.
So if we take that, they're spread all over, but that's the largest group of city employees is in that section. So they're going to be paying, with a 3% increase, they'll be paying $8 more a year, so $96, just less than $100 more for the whole year. However,
What Gary mentioned, and I think this is important, especially for our employees, to their bottom line, is in the month of December, we're doing a premium holiday, which means they will not have a deduction out of their paycheck for the premium amount for that month. And in 1 month time, premium under that program, Jan, is over $200.
$263.
So the $100 more that they're going to be paying over time is going to be offset. And we are able to do the premium holiday reduction. And it goes directly to why I had Gary talk about the claims experience, because we feel like claims experience, if we're having a good year and claims are down, that's a good time for us to return that savings to the employees. Mm-hmm. And doing that in a one-time manner with the premium holiday in December seems like a good time to do it. So as long as we're all working together to stay healthy, and we recognize there are certain diseases or health issues that are out of control of individuals, but it is kind of a way to return back the savings to the employees on kind of a one-time basis. So that's the 263, but okay, about $100 more for the year, but they'll get it in 1 month. We will not deduct the 263 from their paycheck. And that's just one example for the most of the employees. And it kind of varies from others to others. And Jan, I don't know, maybe.
It ranges from $118 to $535, depending upon whether you have single coverage in the choice plan or whether you have family coverage in the copay plan, our most expensive plan. So it's a very good premium mm-hmm. subsidy reimbursement.
It's a good retention program, too.
Oh, yeah. Keep them here.
Stay till December, anyway.
Council, any questions? Mr. Freeman, you had a question.
Mr. Bray, is this going to be analyzed year to year, whether the
savings? Oh, we do
savings,
that. Every year we every come year. Back and do this. Yeah, okay. we'll come back a year from
employees
now.
Employees should appreciate, and, you know, all of us appreciate
Oh, yeah.
That.
And, again, the benefits plan is done on the calendar year, unlike the mm-hmm. budget, which is done on the fiscal year. So that's why we're having this conversation now. But it'll carry us through for the next year, and then we'll come back again and do the same analysis and look for opportunities to have savings and evaluate our claims history.
Okay. Mayor, you have any questions?
No, thank you.
Okay.
That sounds good. Thank you.
All righty. Thank you. Thank you, Jen.
Thank you,
Gary. Next item is here, a presentation and discuss the unspent community development block grant funding and provide direction on the distribution of the unspent funds. Liz Morales.
Good morning.
Morning, Dennis, and morning, Liz.
Good morning again. We are here on a different discussion now. This is related to our CDBG funding, and I have Dennis Newburn, who manages all our funding processes, and the purpose of today is to let you know that we do have funding that is not currently allocated to any specific project, and we also, once we explain that, we'll ask for your direction on whether we should conduct a special funding to commit these funds. So unallocated funds is often the big question. Why do you have funding that's not in use? A lot of that has to do with what we call program income. So projects that incur income has to come back to our program. Also, we often will have projects that don't fully utilize the funding that we've awarded them. And so as we build those up over the last 2-3 years, we have come to the point where we have just approximately 700,000, just a little bit below that. And so we need to commit those and spend those because if we don't do that, the consequences could be that we don't meet our federal requirements, which are what we call a 1.5 ratio, the ratio of the amount of money we are spending to the amount of money we're allocated by HUD. And so HUD looks at that every April 30th. So around this time of year, we look and see, you know, do we have some funds that we can make sure we get spent, and we anticipate with this, if we do the supplemental, we will far exceed our requirements by April 30th, and it puts us in a real good position. We don't like to be too tight and run too close to deadlines. If we do a special funding criteria, we are recommending these eligible activities related to public facilities and improvements, commercial rehabilitation, acquisition, which could be to purchase property for any project, economic development, and that is, has some specific criteria to it, and also accessibility, which is getting residential units, those items for persons with disabilities in order for them to fully utilize their homes. The special funding cycle would, we would be asking projects to fully expend those funds by June 30th, that they'd be shovel ready, meaning pretty much everything's in place with plans and engineering and all the details of that, along with a validated timeline. So not just give us what you think it's going to take you, but show us some projections that have some validity to it. And also, we would give greater funding consideration if they can have a majority of the funding spent by March 30th. The timeline of doing this supplemental would be the public notice would go out. We would open up the funding opportunity as of the 30th, right?
Sunday.
On Sunday, with a close date of November 1st. We will have public meetings to make sure all applicants understand what the requirements are, and we would come back to council with funding recommendations in December. Those who are looking to find out more information, it's on our website, and it's listed there. Any questions?
Council, any questions?
Kevin, go ahead.
Mr. Thompson.
I guess the one thing that I would really like to see is if we were to go back out and maybe work with our parks and facilities and maybe with economic development, mm-hmm. and see if we can identify some projects that would be for the betterment of our entire community, mm-hmm. Or betterment of community in general. Because I know we can use the funds in that manner, mm-hmm. and then come back to us with ideas of where we can utilize those funds best. Throughout the entire city.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Freeman.
Yeah, along the same lines as Councilmember Thompson, I know we've talked about it. There, economic development is a key for our downtown area. Mm-hmm. Specifically, I know there's some light rail issues I've talked to you about, mm-hmm. even with the policing of the light rail, along with maybe some acquisition of some historic buildings and turning them into innovation hub, mm-hmm. and helping businesses grow, so mm-hmm. a business innovation district. Mm-hmm. We traveled a couple years ago to the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and that's always kind of in the back of my mind. They took these old machine buildings, and I know you...
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And converted them into a great office space and business hub. Mm-hmm. So
yes.
There's things around here perhaps we could utilize, not only in this area, but throughout the whole city.
Thank you.
That's what I'm thinking about, too.
Yeah. Mayor, you have any comments?
No, just thank you for the presentation. I think it's going to be important to get the word out, and I know so that we can see what good shovel-ready ideas there are out in the community, and I think this will be a very competitive process, but I'm excited to see what projects come forward.
Sure. Thank you. I spoke to you yesterday. Mm-hmm. Anything related to parks and recreation would be great. So mm-hmm. that's something that I would be interested in. All righty.
Thank you.
No other questions? Okay. Thank you so much. Next, we're going to hear a presentation and provide direction on various proposed tax amendments to the city's zoning ordinance. And we're going to invite John Wesley and Veronica Gonzalez.
Good morning, Mayor, Vice Mayor, Council. Again, John Wesley, Planning Director. I have with me Veronica Gonzalez, planner in our office who works closely with the Board of Adjustment and our zoning ordinance. We're here today to discuss with you and seek your direction on some potential text amendments to the zoning ordinance. We have a long list of things. We continue to monitor the ordinance and where it's working, where it's not, as things evolve and change in places we can make improvements to the ordinance. We've had a few things that have kind of risen to the top recently based on some input questions that have come up from some public, some things that staff has specifically noticed, and other the change to the building codes that have prompted us to put together a list of things that we'd like to seek council direction on. a lot of times when we look at these, the direction we want to go and what we need to do with the ordinance is pretty clear cut. With several of these, it's not maybe quite so clear cut, so that's why we're here seeking the council direction on each one of these to help us determine if we need to move forward with any of these, and if so, kind of what that direction should be. So, Veronica, if you could do the... So the first slide here just gives you the list of things we want to talk to you about today. And in a moment, I'll turn it over to Veronica, and she will touch on each one of these. And so, again, we're seeking council direction on these. In some cases, again, your direction may be leave the code alone. And some we may want to institute special use permits or council use permits to help deal with them. We may need some additional development standards and modify some of the existing standards to better facilitate the type of development that we're talking about. And again, with the update to the building codes, we've got a specific change. We're going to talk about moving something from Title IV into Title XI with regard to light and illumination. So with that kind of quick background, I'll turn it over to Ms. Gonzalez. She'll talk with you about each one, and with each one, we'll, after we finish the presentation, look for your direction on what we would want to do, if anything, with the item.
Thank you, Mr. Wesley, Mayor, Vice Mayor, Council members. The first item we have here is pertaining to special events. Special events are temporary uses that are allowed in all zoning districts. They do have time limitations on them, a maximum of 4 consecutive days, and no more than 4 events may be held in a calendar year. Organizers of a special event may apply for a special use permit to exceed these time limitations, subject to approval of the by the Board of Adjustment. The exception to these special events are the uses that are listed here. In the definition of a special event, the wedding ceremonies, funerals, holiday boutiques, all of these uses here are specifically excluded as a special event. So they are not actually eligible for an extension or be able to be used under the special event category. Specific to wedding ceremonies, they have always been considered a commercial use and are allowed in all commercial zoning districts by right. Due to a recent request we received from a resident here in the city pertaining to allowing wedding ceremonies to be held in residential districts. So we are seeking the council's direction with regard to this particular use on whether to change the definition of a special use, a special event, to include wedding ceremonies so that they could be eligible for a special use permit to exceed the time limitations that we have on special events, or to allow as an accessory use in all zoning districts with either the approval of a special use permit by the Board of Adjustment or a council use permit with approval by the council. In either case, so whether the special use permit or the council use permit, whichever you provide us direction on, we would include a requirement that the applicant provide some kind of an operational plan where they would address frequency of use, parking, noise, to address compatibility with adjacent uses, particularly if we're looking in residential districts where things like traffic and noise and parking may be of a concern to a neighborhood.
Mr. Whitaker.
What's the cost of one of these permits?
A special use permit, I believe, is $1,250.
So, to clarify, if somebody had a wedding and they went back to a residential address to just celebrate for a few hours, it's my understanding that then they would have to apply to receive one of these permits, or is this for residential addresses that are constantly used as locations, not just one-offs?
Yes, Vice Mayor, Councilmember Whitaker, that's what we're really talking about, are those places who want to do it on a regular basis. Certainly people do occasionally have a wedding in their backyard, a reception in their backyard. We're not talking about those things that would happen on that infrequent basis.
And this, that would be required once a year, or how often would they have to apply for these permits?
Vice Mayor, Councilmember Whitaker, typically they run for a limited period of time. However, for somebody who really does it on a frequent, ongoing basis, the Board of Adjustment has at times approved those for multiple years.
Oh, okay. So it's not something that would have to be applied for on every single occasion?
Not necessarily, depending on how it would get approved.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Freeman.
So, John, these use permits, would they be attached to the parcel or to the business?
Vice Mayor, Councilmember Freeman, to the parcel.
Yeah, see, I would prefer, if possible, they attach to the business and not the parcel in case ownership changed on the parcel, and then repetitively they would be using that same parcel for that same function. By having it attached to the business, then if it changed ownership as a council or board of adjustment, it could be reviewed again and see if they've met all the criteria for future, you know, future permitting. So that'd be one of my comments.
Sure.
On
Chair, and Councilmember Freeman, another way to address that is back to part of Councilmember Whitaker's question is the time frame in which that permit's given. If it's just given for a year, if ownership does change, it's still not it's still going to expire.
Okay, so the permit is for 1 year.
But again, typically we do it for that time frame, whatever the Board of Adjustment or Council, whether it came here as a Council Use Permit or Board of Adjustment, whatever time frame would be put on it, it would expire after that period of time.
John, the council could have that discretion.
Correct. That's correct. Yes.
Okay, yeah, I'd still personally support having it attached to the business, not the parcel. But that's my,
real quick,
I don't know what the attorney thinks about it, but.
One more comment real quick, Vice Mayor and Council Members and Mayor. Right now, we've given these a quick look at what some of the options might be. If we're given direction to pursue it, we'll certainly go look at each of these in more detail and flesh out some of the more detailed responses and issues and needs.
Mr. Thompson.
As I'm reading through this and I look at the last bullet where it talks about shall include an operational plan that addresses frequency of use, parking, and noise mitigation to ensure compatibility with adjacent uses. And we're talking about wedding ceremonies and special events. But I think we all received an email about a bar or something where they had a band in a residential area that, you know, all of a sudden has been playing until 2 o'clock in the morning, and they're not required to go through this same level of mitigation and compatibility of area uses. So are we differentiating now between business types? So certain businesses do have to, some businesses don't have to. You know, where do we, at what point do we say all businesses, irregardless of where you're at, are going to have to abide by a noise mitigation plan or a parking plan or whatever else? Because it seems like we're picking and choosing here all of a sudden. And I want to make sure that we're not shooting ourselves in the foot for future events. You know, in fact, Councilmember Whitaker has a person in his district that they thought it was my district, but, you know, was having issues with lawnmowers mowing the golf courses in the morning because they mow at weird times to make sure the golfers are out. And so there's, you know, we have noise ordinances in place, but then we allow for them in some areas. We just say, yeah, don't mind about that. And others we do. So, you know, instead of picking and choosing and blurring the lines between what's allowed and what's not allowed, I think we need to have a better ordinance or better look at how do we solve this problem long-term for all businesses so that we're not all getting emails from residents saying, hey, the bar next door is playing thumping, pounding music until 2 o'clock in the morning. And this guy is only having a wedding ceremony, you know, once a month or twice a month or what have you.
Thank you. Vice Mayor, Councilmember Thompson, along that same line, I think as we look back at the list of items that are currently prohibited to be considered as special events, they are commercial related uses. And I think they've been prohibited for that specific reason, not wanting to let these commercial uses creep into our residential districts. If we should decide to allow this one, it kind of opens that door to then where, what's the next one that's going to want to creep in? And what would the impact be on the neighborhoods? And as we allow these, we do have those impacts that happen, the noise, the parking, the traffic, those kinds of things.
Okay. Mr. Whitaker.
So to clarify, the businesses currently today are not allowed. What happens today if they want to hold a wedding venue inside of a residential neighborhood? Is it there's no permit, they just do it, and... Or is it the opposite, where they're not allowed to?
So, again, Vice Mayor, Councilman Whitaker, if somebody just chooses to do that, my daughter's getting married, I want to hold her ceremony in my backyard, that's going to happen. There's no enforcement of that. If I start having weddings every week at my house for whoever I want to do it to, that would become a code compliance issue and is not permitted by the code today.
So today it's not permitted, but what you're suggesting is that in some of these residential areas that have large properties, they should be able to apply for this specific special use permit, where it would be excluded.
Yes, Councilmember Whitaker, we have had a request by a person who provides wedding ceremonies to amend our code to allow it so they can have them at their home. It's not necessarily a larger lot, but once we would do it, it would be open for anybody in the community to request the permit as a business.
Yeah. Because I think there's multiple properties, I would say probably up in Freeman's district, where they have large acreage lots. I think I've even been to a couple of the receptions, you know, where it's the house on multiple acres. So, I'm all for this. If it wasn't permitted before, I think they should at least be able to apply for some type of permit to have those things in residential.
Mr. Freeman.
Councilmember Thompson, you need to come to the restaurant and hear the music over there. No, you know, I've had, since I inherited this office, we've had a number of people, residents, holding wedding receptions at their home, and they consistently do that, and I've heard the complaints on both sides, and I would like to see something done with that. I mean, it would just strengthen our position as a city, police department, other boxes to check, to, you know, whether they can have that type of event at their residential home. The other thing I kind of circled was VRBO rentals. In some communities, those are a big issue. I don't know if that falls in the same text or amendments. Okay, you're shaking your head. No. All right, we'll cover that later. But
state law.
Okay. But I think these are good things to look at and move forward and see where we end up.
So, Vice Mayor, it seems like I'm hearing direction to go ahead and explore this topic a little bit more and see what we come up with as far as the concrete recommendations. Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll go on to the next item then.
Next, we have car washes. Car washes are allowed in commercial and employment districts with approval of a special use permit. What we have been noticing recently is with the adoption of the 2011 update to the zoning ordinance, there is an additional special use permit criteria, review criteria that we have for car washes. And that is if there are already two existing auto-related uses, which could be auto repair, service stations, auto rental lots, if two of those uses are already occupying two of the four corners at the intersection, a car wash may not be located within 600 feet of that corner. I have a little graphic here. Hopefully you can see it. What that does is that it does put some limitations on where a car wash could be located. If we've got some vacant land in a commercially zoned area where they would need a special use permit, but they're less than 600 feet away from the corner and there are already two service stations on two of the four intersection corners.
Veronica, Mr. Thompson has a question.
John, we dealt a little bit with this. I'd like to see something that also excludes from certain residential areas. Quick Quack is popping up on pretty much every corner in District 6. I think we have the dirtiest cars in Mesa in my district. But, you know, we're starting to get a lot of pushback, as you recently saw, when the neighborhoods come out in mass and say, you know, I don't want the car wash right behind my house. And so I think not only should we be looking at the commercial and employment districts, but we should be looking at residential and best use locations for these car wash type facilities because of the noise and the smells and stuff like that. Nobody really wants that directly in their backyard if you live on a corner lot. And so I think one of the things we should start looking at as well is exactly where they located and so forth.
Okay. Thank you, Councilmember Thompson, for that. And that gets at the two basic questions that we have here. In many instances, we've kind of wondered, is a special use permit really even necessary for car washes anymore? There are several regulatory requirements that go with them in terms of noise dampening and so forth. People are used to them. Maybe we don't need the special use permit, but we have experienced at least that one occasion recently in your neighborhood, your district, where it was very important to the neighbor. So it was good we had that special use permit process that gave that extra review. So I would say we probably do want to at least keep that special use permit process. And it sounds like you're maybe suggesting to look a little bit closer about maybe what some of those other environmental impacts are to see if there's some other things to specifically address so we can do that. The second part of the question is there a reason to further restrict car washes as opposed to any other auto-related use to push them that 600 feet away from the intersection? We could have the two convenience stores right at the corner and put one just immediately east of that, so now you have three within 600 feet, but you couldn't do a car wash. And so what is special about a car wash that we're restricted it even more than the other auto-oriented uses? Is there a feeling that we need to have that extra restriction on car washes? Would you like us to look at that?
Mm-hmm. Any questions, Cousin?
I'm sorry, Vice Mayor, I do have a quick question.
Okay. Go ahead, Mayor.
John, what was the rationale behind this requirement initially? Why are car washes perceived as being more disruptive to a neighborhood than other types of automotive use?
Mayor, unfortunately, I don't really have a good answer for you. We're not exactly sure where that 600-foot separation for car washes only came from in the current code compared to maybe some of the other auto-oriented uses. They are maybe a little bit more impactful to the activity at an intersection in terms of the traffic movements that happen, some of the noise issues and so forth that come from them. Maybe that generated that extra requirement to push them further from the intersection. But again, we don't have a clear answer, and so we do think it probably warrants some study.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we remove the limitation or we expand the limitation. I mean, maybe the rationale behind paying close attention to automotive uses because they're disruptive to residential uses ought to be broadened to include uses in addition to car washes. So I think it's something that we ought to explore.
Okay.
Next, we have convenience stores with accessory fuel sales. Convenience stores on their own are allowed in all commercial zoning districts by right. However, if they were to add fuel sales, as most today do, it does require approval of a special use permit. So here with the options we are asking for council's direction on is to remove the requirement for a special use permit when we have convenience stores with accessory fuel sales, or to amend the section of the code that pertains to additional review criteria for convenience stores with fuel sales and create a set of review criteria for those specific types of uses. Since we typically don't see convenience stores by themselves anymore, and we don't typically see service stations by themselves anymore, they're nowadays more combined.
Mm-hmm. Council?
Question, what's the current, is there any current, when they have fuel, don't they have like the tanks underneath? Is there environmental pieces there on how, it, like if they close it down, that they clean up, or is that part of this process, or is it just having the application to have this? What's the?
Sure.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, Vice Mayor. Councilmember Hodetti, within the zoning ordinance, there are no additional requirements with regard to the fuel tanks and their removal. Those are environmental requirements that are contained other places, particularly by the state. And Mrs. Olinker can help provide some more of that information if you need it. But for the zoning code perspective, it is anytime you're doing the fuel cells, the special use permit is required in conjunction with the convenience store. We've been doing many of these over the years. We never get any citizen comments or input on this. Seems to be, at this point, an extra step for applicants to go through that may not really be necessary anymore. So that's kind of our question to you with regard to the SUP.
So they do have to have, there's an extra layer on the state side that when they do have fuel tanks or, yep.
Mayor, Councilmember Hereditti. Yes, absolutely. The underground storage tank regulations are under the Environmental Protection Agency, delegated at statewide level to ADEQ, and they have very restrictive regulations on making sure the tanks don't leak. If they, mostly they're in vaults these days. They're not just stuck in the ground like they were 20 years ago, but that's totally separate from any land use perspective.
Mr. Whitaker.
So it sounds like you're recommending to remove this special use permit because nobody ever comes to comment on these, and it's just an extra step. That's a waste of time, essentially.
Vice Mayor, Councilmember, that's our feeling at this point.
I'm all for whatever you guys recommend. Thank you, John.
Mayor? Mayor, do you have any comments?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Mr. Freeman?
I concur. If it streamlines the process, then let's not have applicants go through an additional process.
All right.
Next, we'd like to address what we call legal non-conforming single or duplex residences. For this particular situation, and it really primarily impacts older homes, basically homes that were built prior to 2011 with the update of the zoning ordinance. So with these legal existing non-conforming homes, if they wanted to enlarge or alter the home up to 50% of the original square footage without providing any additional parking, meaning bringing it up to current code, they would be required to apply for a special use permit through the Board of Adjustment to do that. Our proposal before the council today is to perhaps remove the special use permit requirement through the Board of Adjustment and maybe instead look at doing an administrative use permit that could be done through the zoning administrator on a staff level.
And there's a fee to go to the Board of Adjustment.
That's correct. Again, with this, yes, with this being a special use permit, that would be the $1,250 through the board. And I believe the administrative use permits are $25. There's a significant difference in the cost.
And just the scheduling, too, for the Board of Adjustments only meets, how often do they meet? Monthly?
Mr. Brady, the Board of Adjustment meets once a month. And, you know, with an administrative use permit, that could be done at any time.
Mr. Freeman?
I'm with you. I mean, let's streamline the process. Yeah. I don't know how the other colleagues.
Mr. Whitaker.
I just have one question. Is there an override process if it's denied administratively? Would they be able to go to the Board of Adjustment to seek some form of override or?
Yes.
Okay. Great.
Okay. Mayor, any questions? I think we're good.
And finally, lighting and illumination, which is found in Chapter 30 of the Zoning Ordinance. The City of Mesa is expected to adopt the 2018 International Code Council of Codes and the 2017 National Electric Code in early 2019. To coincide with that, what we would propose to do is amend the chapter of the zoning ordinance, Chapter 30, pertaining to lighting and illumination to coincide with the adoption of these codes and essentially take Title 4, Chapter 4 of the Mesa City Code, which is the Mesa Lighting and Electrical Code, and incorporate that directly into the zoning ordinance so it's all in one place, again, to coincide with the adoption of the new codes.
Okay. Council, any comments on that? Mr. Freeman.
Okay, I stick my hand on all kinds of things during the week and the month. Christine, does that apply to anything we're dealing with a constituent lighting issue on the street? Or is this something separate?
This is actually a bit separate. Your issue that we're currently dealing with really has to do with the public right-of-way and lighting for traffic safety. This is primarily talking about the land use, illumination standards, for apartments, for homes, that kind of thing, not the lighting on the public right-of-way.
Got it. Thank you.
Great. Council, any questions? Mr. Whitaker.
So it sounds like you're just getting rid of our local and just adopting the national standards, if I'm understanding you correctly?
Vice Mayor and Councilman Whitaker, currently we have lighting illumination standards in the zoning ordinance and some in Title IV related to the building codes. And rather than having it split in two places, we'll put it all in one so it's easier for people to use, but it's all local ordinances. There's nothing in the actual national codes dealing with this topic.
Okay, great. I appreciate you guys cleaning all this up. I'm sure it helps streamline business and make everything more efficient, so thank you.
Okay. Mr. Mayor, do you have any questions?
No, thank you.
Okay, I think we're good. Thank you.
Vice Mayor, Council, thank you. We've gotten direction on each item. We will work these through the process, and at some point in the next few months or so, you'll see some of these start to come back after we've been at P&Z.
Thank you.
All right, thank you so much. Next item is acknowledged receipt of various board minutes. Is there a motion for approval? Second. Okay, it's been made. A motion has been made by Councilmember Glover, seconded by Councilmember Freeman. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay.
Aye.
Okay, motion passes. Item four here, reports on meetings and conferences attended.
Mr. Vice Mayor?
Yes. Yes, Mayor.
I probably ought to explain why I'm on the phone. I am attending a conference right now with Chief Ramon Batista of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. So we're going to be making a presentation in just another hour or so about what we're doing in Mesa on a variety of things, but particularly on making schools safe. But other topics, including homelessness and human trafficking and community engagement, are being discussed here. So I think it's a productive place for the chief and I to be.
Excellent. All righty. Any other comments? Mr. Brady, if you schedule future meetings and general information.
Thank you, Vice Mayor. Just a reminder, our next study session, council meeting on Monday and study session October 4th. And I believe today, right? So we have two mobile council offices. Is that, should we call it that? Councilman Heredia will be having his mobile office hours today from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at the Dobson Ranch Library. So I encourage everyone to come out to that location. And Councilmember Glover will also be having conversations with Chris. Wow, that sounds very formal. Tonight from 5:30 to 6:30 at the Visit Mesa office, which is located at 120 North Center. Thank you very much.
Great. All righty. Anything else, Council? Okay, can I have a motion for adjournment? Okay. Been moved and seconded by Mr. Glover and Freeman. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay. Meeting's adjourned.